everybody, and welcome to today's episode of Attendance Bias. I am your host, Brian Weinstein. We've covered plenty of shows from the summer of 1999 on Attendance Bias, but lest we forget, there was a lot more to that year than a raucous summer tour. There was also a fall tour and a lesser-explored December tour, which took place entirely within the last month of the millennium. Today's guest, Brent Somerville, chose one of the last Phish shows of 1999, December 16th at the Reynolds Coliseum in Raleigh, North Carolina, to review today. Although portions of the show are available on YouTube, there are certain nuances that we can only hear from someone who is in attendance. Luckily, we have Brent here to tell us all about it. At the time, Brent was moving back to North Carolina from Michigan, and he had been seeing Phish for 5 years. He brought a friend to this show, which he rarely did at the time, and was on his old college campus, where he had lots of ties to this small basketball court-turned-concert venue. Phish broke out a monster second set for this show, and it joined the fabled five-song second set club, with a version of Sand full of soundscapes, as well as a soul-cleansing tweezer. But there's more to it than that. Let's join Brent to chat about college basketball, Trey's keyboard setup, and cold Michigan winters as we revisit December 16th, 1999 at the Reynolds Coliseum in Raleigh, North Carolina. Brent, welcome to Attendance Bias. How are you today?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be on here.
It's a real pleasure to have you, and I'm super excited to talk about the show that you picked today, which is December 16th, 1999 at the Reynolds Coliseum in Raleigh, North Carolina. And number one, it's a show I'd never heard before.
Nice.
And second, I believe, and we'll get into this a little more later, but I think this is only the second show of the December 99 tour, which I think is kind of, I don't know if this is a word, but I'll make it one, underexposed in the larger Phish psyche.
Yeah, I was fortunate to somehow go to this show. I don't even remember the exact context, but it's pretty close to Big Cypress. So like in some of your notes, I think they were really getting themselves ready in this little December run or tour.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that, the difference between a run and a tour in just a couple of minutes. Brent, let's get to know you a bit, though, as a fan with the Attendance Bias Lightning Round.
Attendance Bias Lightning Round.
Brent, when was your first Phish show, and what do you remember from it?
It was 4/24/94 in Charlotte, North Carolina, at the Grady Cole Center. I was 21 years old, and I went with my oldest friend, Keck, and we arrived late. I distinctly remember walking along the brick wall of the this kind of gymnasium-type venue and hearing them play My Friend Through the Wall, and then picking our pace up a bit to get inside and see the show.
So is the Grady Cole Center like a community center?
It's like a basketball gym. I believe the Charlotte Hornets practiced there back in the day, something like that. It's just a pretty small gymnasium. I looked up the attendance and it was 2,765. So it's a small gym.
Wow.
The sound was a little mushy, and when I looked it up, it was $16.50 for that ticket.
Oh, wow. Well, how did you get that ticket? What brought you to Phish?
Oh, yeah, it must have been Keck. I think I saw that Phish was doing something on Horde Tour. There was some connection with Blues Traveler, and so my friend Keck and I started listening to Phish, and I got some tapes, and I just really liked them, and I was excited for this first show in 94. I also had a friend in Raleigh where I was going to school at NC State, Keller, and she was friends with Fishman. So that was another connection that got me inspired to go see a Phish show.
What was the most recent Phish show that you saw, and what did you think of it?
Right. Yeah, I saw Phish kind of steady along the way since 94. But, you know, I work remotely now out of Boone, North Carolina here in Boulder, Colorado. For the last 3 years post-COVID, since then, we've been going to the Dix Run and starting in 2021. So my last show was night four of the summer 2023 Dix Run, which would be 9/3/23. It was a great run. All the Dix Runs have been really fun. interestingly enough, I was late again for this, my last fish show. It was night four. I'm like 50 years old, but doing great out there in this 4-night run. But night four, it was like 4:30. I said, I'm going to take a little nap. And my wife woke me up at 9:23 p.m. You know, it's a 7:30 show. So I'm like, we've just missed the first set. Panicked. Got a text that said, hey, they're about to go on. And they went on at 9:27 p.m. because of a weather delay.
Wow. The world, you know, fate was on your side.
Yeah, so we booked it in and only missed Sigma opener and walked in during Down With Disease. Very thankful to not have missed the whole show.
Wow, someone was looking out for you.
That's right. My wife. So it was it was a fun show. Gumbo, I love. 2001, my friend and I decided when they played 2001, we twirl our shirts in the air. Fuego. I mean, we boogied and had a great night for there in Commerce City.
To get a little bit away from the best vibes, we'll go a little bit controversial. What is your most controversial fish opinion?
It might be that I pretty much like all fish songs and that there are no pee break songs for me. Like, for instance, I went to the Wilmington shows and night one scored pretty low. But at the end, I was like, you know what? They just played a lot of fish songs and I liked all of them. But probably, you know, some parts of some songs get on my nerves. And for me, it's probably Axela. And, you know, if they play it, I don't leave, but I'm like, oh, this song's annoying. But then it's not in reality. I end up liking it, but there's something about it.
Now, have you been this way the whole time as a fan? Or my thought is this a result of our, pardon me, but age and wisdom as fans, where it's kind of like, it's not worth that negative energy to pick out songs that you don't like and go to the bathroom and shrug your shoulders and roll your eyes? Or have, since 1994, have you liked all fish songs?
Yeah, I mean, fish can almost do no wrong with me. But you know, when I'm at a show and I hear a song that I know is a pee break song and I see people exiting, I'm like, I don't want to be a part of this. So I was like, feel bad for the song. I was like, this is a good song, everyone. Stop going to the bathroom. Maybe I'm just overly positive. They, you know, I've seen such a variety of fish. I know that they get out there, they take chances. Sometimes it lands, sometimes it doesn't, but I'm here for all of it. And I just so much like being there as it's happening.
I like the idea of the personification of fish songs as if, you know, we're hurting Sugar Shack's feelings. Don't you realize it?
Right. The only other thought I've had maybe the last couple of years is when with this tray set up with the Train Wreck amp, sometimes it's been harsh to my ears. Like it really came out in the Charleston shows in the spring 22 run. I was next to a fella and he'd never been to a fish show, but he'd been to 200 dead shows. And Trey came out big time with something. And he said, if Jerry's guitar sounds like rain, Trey sounds like Godzilla, just like blasting the crowd with this tone. And I was like, yeah, it is a little harsh, isn't it? But, you know, that's about as much as I'll complain at a fish show. Just like, wow, this is loud. But, you know, I told him, like, you try getting up there and turning that train wreck up and hitting a note and see how it sounds. You know, sure. That's brave. That's brave to blast out that loud of a tone. It's amazing.
And you know, if Jerry guitar sounds like rain and Trey sounds like Godzilla, that almost sounds like a compliment. You know, Godzilla, he's just misunderstood.
That's right. And he always saves the day. That's right. Even though he causes some calamity along the way.
Yeah, he's a victim of circumstance.
That's right.
So looking back at this year, we're recording right now in the last quarter of 2023. We were lucky enough this year to have both a spring tour and a fall tour, which most years we might not get either, but they were kind of condensed tours. So to your point earlier about tours and runs, is 8 shows in 3 cities truly a tour?
Yeah. And, you know, this gets to my, I don't know, business sense of writing policy and trying to be clear. In my vernacular, I use run for like a New Year's run, a Halloween run, a Dick's run. And a tour is multi-city. So even if it's a short tour, I still call it a tour. But a run is like, oh, they came into town and they did their little Halloween run. And that's just how I use it. So I don't know if that's right or wrong.
Well, I wonder, because I love semantics. I am all about, yeah. I could eat this up for an hour to the chagrin of our listeners. But if a run is basically an extended stay at a venue, so the Baker's Dozen was a residency, though. Was it also a run, or was it two separate words?
Oh, that's right. So yeah, we could write this up. You know, multi-city is a tour. Four nights or less is a run, and more than four nights, we'll call it a residency. So yeah. I don't know the definitions, but we could get there.
We'll write up the user guide for new hires. Right. Well, finally, and I love this question, going all the way back to 1994 to recently, what is the weirdest thing you've ever seen at a fish show?
Yeah, when I hear you ask your question, your guest this question, I'm like, you know, I remember all these moments of like, did y'all see that? Did I just see that? Did that just happen? But I can't remember the moment that I was actually seeing. But yeah, there's one time we were, through a family connection, we were gifted, my partner and I, gifted tickets to 12/31/97, and including a place to stay way down near the Twin Towers. Free tickets. And back then, they had seats on the floor at MSG, and we were sixth row, page side, just incredible seats for a New Year's Eve show. And next, you know, as the show went on, this creature next to us with just a lion's mane of hair was dancing so crazy that he had this 10-foot diameter spot cleared out around him. And it was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. And never thought much of it, but I was watching a video of the Europe tour, and I saw Antelope Greg on the front doing that. And I was like, oh my gosh, we were next to Antelope Greg. And I guess so. I mean, I didn't really realize he had all that hair back then.
I didn't realize that either. The first time I ever met Antelope Greg was in 2011. It was at Bethel Woods when they played the three nights of Memorial Day weekend at Bethel Woods in upstate New York. And my then partner and I had tickets. We weren't gifted them, but we had like second row back from like center stage. The lotto blessed us for that run. And so we were second row, and there was this guy in front of us, short hair, almost not quite a crew cut, but almost a shaved head, somewhere in between, just going insane, just dancing like crazy for the entire first set, sweating buckets. Just, and did not stop. His shirt was soaked through. And every time, you know, we would like move a little bit, he would turn around and whip toward us, and he wouldn't say anything. He would just kind of box us out effectively. Yeah. But in between songs and during set break, he was the most polite guy in the world. You know, there were some people who were trying to get ahead of us just to get a front row seat for a song to say they were in the front. And the security was trying to get them back. But this guy, who I didn't know who it was, would go to security and point at me and my then wife and say, oh, no, these guys are cool. They belong here. In this like authoritative voice, like he's the one who owns the spot. And I only found out after the fact that it was Antelope Greg.
Well, if my theory is right, back in the late 90s, he had a massive mane of white man afro going on.
When was this show played?
Well, today's show that was played on December 16th, 1999, was part of the 1999 December run, which is different from the summer tour. By far, you know, I looked up some of the stats for this show because when I started Attendance Bias, it seemed like every other guest was choosing shows from 1999. It is by far the most chosen year on Attendance Bias. But when I looked, it's almost exclusively shows from the 1999 summer tour. So I think it's just a matter of my age group and the people around me who I know that just got on board in the time where they were in college or they were just past college and they could afford to tour, and maybe also were in between responsibility ages where they could just do an entire tour, and 1999 meant the most to them. But December tour was very different than summer tour that year. Even the sound was very different inside, like what the band was playing. So just numbers wise, the December 99 tour was made up of 14 shows in 17 days. So it began on December 2nd at the Palace in Auburn Hills. They went south to Cincinnati for two shows, east to Rochester for a memorable show, one of the best of this tour, on December 5th. And then they went farther east to Portland, Maine. They ended up in Philadelphia for that December 11th show, which has been covered on this podcast. Many would argue probably the show of the tour. And after Philly, it went up and down the Northeast Corridor to Hartford, Providence, D.C., and then today's show in Raleigh, which was very close to the end of the tour, which was in Hampton on December 18th. I had a friend named Joseph who covered the Philadelphia show on December 11th. He did this entire tour. And he told me that you could almost feel it in the air, whether it was conversation or just this kind of intangible vibe, that this was all just leading up to Big Cypress. Almost like this was not quite a practice run, but what's the phrase? That all is past is prologue? That this was the prologue to Big Cypress. I don't know how many shows you saw on this tour, but do you remember anything like that? Or what was your general experience of the Winter 99 tour?
Yeah, you know, I only saw this show from that little tour. And I think the previous one was Alpine Valley, because I had just moved from Kalamazoo down to North Carolina. So I missed it a little bit, but I caught only this show in late 99 after maybe just the summer one summer show in 99 and then Big Cypress. But yeah, you're spot on. I mean, I cracked open the volume 6 of the Farmer's Almanac, and this person, James Jolly or Jolie, says, "I'm taping the show as I'm writing this, and it's still giving me chills. Everyone will be talking about Second Night Philly or Second Night Hampton, but this show is unbelievable." This taper was having a good time. And like, don't sleep on this show, you know? So I was happy to be there.
Yeah, I was a high school senior at the time. I had seen two shows on the fall tour at the Nassau Coliseum, October 7th and 8th, and I got tickets for what I would consider an unremarkable show on December 12th at Hartford. And what I remember is the summer tour seemed to have this supersonic, crazy speed guitar wormhole jams. And then toward the fall, it became a little more ambient. A tweezer could be 24 minutes, but you wouldn't be able to hum anything from it after it was over. It was just very spacey, and it went into stuff like My Left Toe and things like that, where there was nothing to hold on to. It was very airy. And then in December, that Hartford show that I saw, it opened the second set with a 30-minute Drowned. Wow. And that's what I remember from it. Like this, a lot of Trey on the keyboard, a lot of beep, bloop, bloop, beep, bloop, beep, bloop. But also they could blow you away on any given jam with their consistency. And we'll get to it. But like the sand from this show is as strong as any.
Yeah. Yeah. The sand from the show is the highlight for me, is why I go back and listen. And the tweezer is great too, but it wouldn't be there without that sand. It's something else.
Well, I don't know if that answers my next question, but maybe I wanted to ask you why you chose this show. Why do you have attendance bias toward December 16th, 99 at Reynolds Arena?
Yeah, I think it was a number of things. First of all, I brought a friend to the show, and I've only done that twice. You know, I'd just moved back down to North Carolina from Michigan. While up in Michigan, I went to some really, had some peak Phish excitement in 97. At Great Went and Palace of Auburn Hills with that Tweezer Bella. And then in 98, living in Kalamazoo, I caught these great shows, UIC Pavilion, Kohl Center, and then took a friend from work to this 11-11-98 show. It was like a freezing cold Wednesday night in Grand Rapids at the Van Andel. And that was a killer show. We could do a show about that one too. But my work buddy was kind of like, didn't quite get it. He's like, this is crazy. Are they still playing a song? What's even happening? But I had a great time. But I took an old childhood friend with me to this Raleigh show in 99, Thad. And Thad's one of those positive people that knows that I thought would just be great to have along. I could show him a little sneak peek of a Phish show. And he was a non-fan, never been to one. And plus, you know, I had graduated from NC State in 95. So this is 4 years after that. I'm now back on campus of my college campus to see a show with an old buddy. And what I knew about this venue was that I'd seen basketball shows, basketball games in there, and it was hot, rowdy, exciting box. And I remember it as being tiny, but this old basketball gymnasium, you know, had really, like, the sides are right on top of the court. And so you're just steeply involved in the game from the sides. And then it had these deep end zones. But I remember it being, going to a basketball game there in the 90s and it being really hot and loud. And I looked up some information about Reynolds Coliseum, and, you know, it was where Jimmy Valvano did his magic coaching basketball in the 80s, including the 83 NCAA championship, which was probably my peak time in my life of being interested in college basketball, was the 80s, around 83. Of course, I liked Jordan. But it says in Wikipedia, Reynolds was, for basketball games, loud, edgy, and intense. So I'm back in this intense old school gymnasium again, but now with my favorite band, Phish, with my old buddy Thad. And it's a gamble bringing someone to a show, because, as I know, I've been to only 60 shows, but you don't always land on a peak transformational experience. Sometimes it's like, well, if you bring a fan, you're like, well, usually they would have, you know, and you're trying to explain what just happened. But it was successful. We had a great time. He was like, wow, you know, thank you so much for bringing me to that experience. I had no idea it would be like that. So all that was, like, you know, a little bit of nostalgia, having a success at bringing a friend to a show. And then really, I like this show because I re-listened to it a lot due to that second set weirdness, and because it really speaks to me.
Set one
opens with Wilson, which is a classic show opener. And of course, my first note is the recordings from this era aren't the best, but since the technology of audio technology, I should say, has been refined so well in the last 24 years, this one is pretty decent. This one is Fishman's bass drum is thunderous on this recording. Yeah. It's much better than what was available at the time. I'm talking about the audience recording on fish.in.
Okay.
There's a hard jam at about 3 minutes and 15 seconds, and it goes for 2 minutes. It reminds me of, like, the backwards guitar playing effect, if you know what I'm talking about, that was very often used in 1998.
Thank you.
Dude, I'm glad you said that because I put in my notes. It sounds like Trey's playing Jimi Hendrix, like playing with his teeth. I was like, this sounds weird. What is this? And yes, backwards guitar. I like it. And that's it's in there for sure. I mean, comes right out with a Wilson. And first of all, if you've ever stood next to a non-Fish fan and they've come out with Wilson, a big smile goes on your face because you look on that person's face and you're like, because all you get is da 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 da, and then the whole crowd knows what to do. And if you didn't see that coming, you're like, I'm at a cult gathering. This is amazing. Yeah. My daughter says it's not like a Taylor Swift concert where everyone's singing every word. It's just like, how do you know when to sing these little parts? It's like, well, we just know it evolves, and it's weird to me to listen back to a Wilson and maybe like 94 and they go da 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 da, and the crowd's like, they don't chant. Yeah. And it's like, oh my God, that's so weird. I can't even listen to that.
Well, that's the thing though, because the band didn't force it. It started in around 1994. But if you listen to the version on a live one, probably the most well-known version, the Wilson chant doesn't start right away. It takes two or three go-rounds of notes for the whole crowd to join in.
The Almanac says that this Wilson was expected because there's a nearby town that you drive through to get to Raleigh called Wilson. I didn't think about it at the time, but
well, next time I'm in Raleigh, I'll check out Wilson, North Carolina. They follow it up with Chalked as Torture, which is perfect in the two hole. It's a very fast, high energy version. And I'm very interested in myself in a weird way, because I wrote in my first notes when I listened to it the first time that it's repetitive. I wrote, it doesn't really go anywhere new, just fun and dependable. But when I re-listened to it yesterday, I thought there was a pretty strong jam right in the heart of it, right around, 5.5 minutes or so.
Yeah. I think this is the first song that hits the jam charts too on Fishnet, because it gets going and is a lot of fun. And it's like Trey's bringing the party with the energy, and couldn't have been a better song in the two hole for sure. I mean, our synapses were burning, and really I've not listened to the audience recording that I don't think I've listened to the version on fish.in, because you can hear the roar of the crowd so well in the live Fish soundboard that I didn't feel the need to go hear that. Usually I would, but it's loud. The crowd is nuts.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and they stay that way throughout the show. And what I liked about this Chalked as Torture is they find ways to stretch it in atypical parts. Like, they don't just jam out the end. And this is kind of a trick, I guess, that they had up their sleeve. My long-term thoughts are that maybe they were trying to do this as an exercise in preparation of Big Cypress, when they knew they were going to have to play for what would maybe be 8 hours straight. They're going to have to find pockets to stretch things out and find jams where previously there wouldn't be any.
Yeah, totally. That has got to be some of the mental work going on. Let's find places to take a walk and have some fun. And they did it right here in the good old Can I Live While I'm Young, which I love every time.
They follow up for a third song with Lawn Boy, which is a cool chill out song. Nothing too different. If you've heard this one, you've heard them all. And then Limb by Limb, which I was just curious, they played it 18 times in 1999. That is a pretty big chunk of Limb by Limb.
It is.
It's never been out of rotation, though, since it was introduced in 1997. It's always been a popular choice. You know, usual Trey Mandarin guitar lead, nothing terribly unusual, but I love when Fishman switches to the woodblocks. Now it sounds kind of serious and what I would call, you know, in capital DP, Dark Fish, for the first time. I liked it a lot.
I did too. And it earned itself again on the jam chart, the two songs from the first set. And I've really not listened back to this limb by limb a lot. I go back to the second set and Let It Rip at the Sand and then kind of peter out at the end of the Tweezer. But I went back and listened to this a few times. And yeah, it's really good. It to me, Limb by Limb is a very Fishy song. It's very Tom Marshall. It's just all things Fish. It's got all of their elements in it. And gosh, at the end when Trey is trilling, he nails it and it just gives me chills. Listening back to it, it's just, and the end of my notes, I said the end of the song is the perfect singing part for Fishman. limb by limb, you know, it's just made for him. And the crowd just goes nuts again after the end of this one.
I love that you paid attention to Trey for the most part when you said, you know, the trilling. I wrote absolute trilling guitar happiness.
Yeah.
At 9 minutes before they bring it back to Limb by Limb with power chords. To me, though, my ear tend to drift toward Fishman in general, not just in this song, but overall when I listen to Fish. And he does something in this version that I don't think I've ever heard happen in Limb by Limb. He falls back to a straight 4-4 drum beat. Makes it simple, which Limb by Limb might be the most complicated drum song they have.
Totally. Yeah, I didn't notice that. And you marked it about 7.5 minutes in, so I'm going to go back and pay attention to that now, because that's really cool.
Yeah, for what it's worth, it doesn't stay that way for very long, but it does show how the band can kind of break structure quickly and then go right back. They are really in each other's heads.
Yeah, it's funny how you can hear Fishman do things live and you listen back to it and you don't get it anymore. Like that happened to me at the Twist and Dick's maybe 22. He's doing this this following mic around, and at the time in person it was just amazing thing. I went back to listen to it and it's gone. It's like you don't get it. But at the time, it was Mike and Fishman were just swirling around, chasing each other like animals. He catches my ear all the time. I try to follow Fishman because he is a lot of fun.
Always, always. And it's such a treat if you get the chance to sit behind him for a show.
Yeah.
It's like one of the best seats, in my opinion, the best seats in a baseball stadium is like behind the catcher, you know, maybe 10 rows up or 10 rows behind. You get to see the whole game. That's how I feel about sitting behind Fishman. Yeah. Where were you sitting for this show? Do you remember?
I do. I remember we're sitting on the page side, I guess, bleachers. It's hard to remember if it was seats or bleachers, and they've also remodeled it. But to me, we're sitting on bleachers and we're looking to the left and we're seeing the band. So we're about mid-court on page side. And I don't have too many great memories from the show, just like clear, but clearly Thad and I are sitting there looking left and there's the band. There's Trey wearing his little beanie because it was a nice cold night.
The next song up is Horn, which I wrote Time for Another Break. It's a clean version. Again, like Lawn Boy, unless you love Horn, nothing outstanding to write home about. It's just a well-placed song. Although his tone is excellent, him being Trey.
Yeah. And I think there's someone that just recently, well, this last year replicated Trey's 99 rig. And it did have this wonderful tone. And I hear it in Horn. It's just beautiful. And yeah, I like Horn. I'm sure I just stood there and smiled and enjoyed every minute.
And then a new song, not brand new, but newer at the time, Back on the Train, was played very heavily during the summer and fall tour. It hasn't been explored too much up to this point, although I will put in a plug for my favorite version ever, which was during Oswego when I think they had Sam Bush. It was like a bluegrass version of Get Back on the Train. If you haven't heard it, highly recommended. Whether you, Brent, or anyone listening, dial it up. But I feel like at the time, Back on the Train was a good 5 to 7 minute song. It introduced some new guitar tones as we talk about them, but a lot of new sounds. Paige, yep, on the Wurlitzer with a chug-a-lug. I hate to use the word filler, but it didn't really break out of itself. It was still finding its personality at this point.
Yeah, no, you're right. I like these early versions of these songs. They get in this groove. And I kind of like this one because it just stays in it so hard. I mean, it's literally a train, mm-hmm, going by. It does not falter. And it's just a solid chug-a-lug-a, as you described it. And I like it every time. But when Trey plays that solo with that effect of, it feels like double sound, round and round and round and round and round and round now. I remember that one filling the venue. It was just once he clicked that or hit it, it was just went around you and came from the back. You know, it was a big sound.
Yeah, I can hear it right now. I knew exactly what you're talking about. It's so and it's like surround sound system.
Yeah, like he's coming from all sides somehow. And he's I don't know which pedal, but it's a good one.
After Back on the Train is Rogue, which is, again, a chill out. The vocals and the harmonies, the musical harmonies, aren't as strong then as they are today. Granted, it's been almost a quarter century. But the piano playing is a little more airy, which I like. It's a little more Page-led, but a little lower stakes in a way. It's almost happier is a way I could describe it, I guess. I don't know. It's perfect for the spinners. Like the people who are out in the corridor just they need their space turning around and around and around. This Rogue is perfect for them. And it remains that way for most of the middle section before it's time for the power chords at the very end.
Yeah. You know, I think Paige sounds just beautiful in this whole show. I mean, these days I'm watching him and I see him turn his back and he goes to the synthesizer and then he moves over here. In this show, I felt like he spends a lot of time on his baby grand. He goes to the roads, goes to the whirly. But it's just all through the show, it's just some beautiful Paige on piano. Even if they're doing the weirdest shit, you hear in the background just Paige playing the piano. And it's like he can make that work with anything. And yeah, it's beautiful here. I recall sitting down here, signaling to my friend, it's okay if we sit down here for a minute. And closing our eyes, just feeling the Rogue. And then those power chords just like vibrating everything. Bow, bow, bow. Oh, I love that. This power chord so much.
Yeah, they really shake your bones. You know, if you're closing your eyes and drifting, that'll bring it back.
Yeah. Yeah. It puts a smile on my face.
And then comes the song of the year. And I don't mean that necessarily from a fan favorite perspective at the time, but the song of the year, they play Heavy Things. And my first thought was it couldn't be 1999. Without Heavy Things. It was played 17 times in 1999, and it didn't even debut until the fall tour at the Gorge.
Wow. Some friends came over recently, and we streamed a show, and Trey said, beep, you know.
Yeah, you always hear it.
And I was like, Heavy Things. They're like, damn, dude, that was killer. But it's, you know, he always plays it, and here is he goes like, beep, beep. Beep. And
I think, he does it three times.
Yeah, like three, four times. And I think at first it's like, oh, he always practices it. So he makes sure he hits it. But now I'm thinking he's recording it on his little loop effect.
That's
what
it is.
So he can beep, 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 beep it, you know. So he's recording it and we're all like, oh, Heavy Things.
Yeah, it's got to tell for sure. Right? If all of Fish was a poker game, Heavy Things would be the worst player. It always reveals itself before they play it. And I don't think if anyone listening wasn't around in 1999, it's hard to tell, to express the derisiveness that some fans had toward this song. Heavy Things was not a popular song. I didn't like it that much. I have to be honest at that. In my mind, infamous show in Hartford, they opened with it. And that came after this big dramatic, we can't get there, we have tickets, are we going, are we not going, last minute, we literally had to take a train to Hartford, we ran in right as the show started, and it was Heavy Things, and that was when I learned Fish doesn't owe me anything, but they played it, I think, 8 times on this December tour, and what did we say, it was 14 shows?
Yeah,
that's a pretty half. Yeah, I am not a mathematician, but, and then they played it again at Big Cypress for the worldwide broadcast.
Yeah, that's what it always makes me think of when they play it now. I mean, first of all, I like it, but I got that it was poppy and kind of funny. But when we're all singing who wah as Trey is soloing, that releases happy chemicals in my brain. I mean, every time Same with Fuego. Oh, those yeah. little sing-alongs are magic. And this one's got the hoo-hoo, wah, and I like it. I know it's cheesy, but I like it. But yeah, when they play this, I think of Peter Jennings.
The Fish.
And Trey's like, all right, we're about to be on ABC News here. And Peter Jennings is like, this is the largest gathering of the millennial countdown in the world. Now we go to Fish. And it's like, everything's all on me, and we're on TV. And I was like, of course they're playing Heavy Things for this moment.
And the idea that you just brought up, the cheesy song being, for lack of a better word, redeemed by kind of a cathartic sing-along ending, yeah. that's more. That's Set Your Soul Free. So what's old is new.
That's right.
Yep, but they follow right. that up, that brand new song, with a really old school song, almost as old as you can get, with Camel Walk. And we're still at the point where this song was a rarity. It had a renaissance in 1997 at the show you brought up, right? At December 3rd. Oh, no, you brought up New Year's Eve 97, the night before.
The night before, I did not go to.
Right. But they broke out Camel Walk there as a big bust out, I think. I could be wrong on that. But Camel Walk now had this expectation that it could be a funk extravaganza.
Yeah.
And I think this is a song that's played just often enough to keep people excited when it's played. Even this time, though, like, there's a composed solo and then a jam at around 2 minutes. It even has a laid back, still improvised feel. This song maintains a vibe throughout it, even if it stays within its lines.
Yeah, I like it. And the Almanac review says, a Camel Walk from out of the blue in the first set made the show remarkable on its own. So people were happy to get this Camel Walk. And I like it every time. My wife does not like Camel Walk. That's her controversial opinion. this one's pretty good. It does get – they do the version of funk where you just remove everything you can until you get to the minimum. And they do it here just like –
Yeah.
You know, I love that. In my mind, though, listening to this one, in my mind, I'm filling in some cool improvisation in that part that I hear more recently, and like some jammed out Camel Walks from the Gorge and things like that. But here they do it justice, and it washed my blues away, and we had a good time for sure.
Good. And we're at the end of the set already, where they close with another classic. They close with Possum. And what I loved about this is in 1999, we talked a bit about their sound, their overall style at the time. Tension and Release was forever ago at this time, right? That was like the big thing in 92, 93, 94, 95. By 99, they were more like, get rid of straight lines, get rid of structure. Everything is spacey. Everything could be 40 minutes long. But this Possum, you want to talk about Tension, Release, Rock and Roll. This has got it in spades.
Yeah, they do it. That was a solid closer. I looked it up. It was my fourth Possum. I've seen 16 now, so I don't get excited by Possum, but it works every time. You know, this was a powerful closer that worked great. And I put in my notes, it's perfect for Mike's singing range. You know, sometimes yeah. Mike even writes a song he can't sing, but this one's just, he nails it every time. So, yeah, I love this Possum.
Hi, everybody. Brian here to welcome you to the set break of today's episode of Attendance Bias. First, thank you for listening. And second, just a quick reminder to tell you that even though Attendance Bias comes to you for free, it does take a lot of work and it does take quite a bit of money to keep the lights on here at production. So I just wanted to ask a small favor if you could support the podcast in any number of the following ways. If you could leave a review or a rating of it on whichever podcast app you use. If you could spread the word, telling a friend or someone you think may be interested in it about it. Or probably the most concrete way is to go to www.buymeacoffee.com/attendancebias and donate however much you can financially to help with the continuing costs of Attendance Bias. So thank you again so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy the second half of today's episode.
Set two.
And for the second set, it opens with your big highlight, Sand. I have my notes, but forget me. You tell us why this sand is so special to you.
Yeah, okay. Well, this sand is special to me because of these crazy layers of whale calls, sirens, loops, and clicks. it's still a bit of a mystery to me how it happened, but I think a lot of it is Trey on his mini keys. Once that stuff rolls out and starts to layer and loop, I'm just blown away by it. Like, I listened to the debut from 9/11/99, and it's clunky. Like, it sounds like they're about to play 2001, but then they get into Sand, and it's pretty good. I listened to, it's a Tab song, so I listened to 5/6/99, which is a YouTube video back when Tab was at its coolest, just Trey, Tony, and Russ Lawton. And the drums do the same thing the whole 20 minutes. Tony Markalis, this is the exact bass line for 20 minutes. And Trey's just trying to figure out, you know, he gets a siren loop going and then he noodles over that. But it's a lot of space. It's very airy. This one, I feel like they just, you know, nailed it. Mike and Fishman could be replaced with a loop of the Tony Markalis bass line. He never departs, not once. Mike does the same thing for the whole 20 minutes, and Fishman does the same thing for the whole 20 minutes. He could be replaced by a drum machine. and even Paige, I don't even think Paige is doing that much. It's mostly Trey in there having a good time and Paige playing along with him, and it's amazing to me.
Yeah, Paige slowly creeps in. This is not the Paige show.
Right.
This Sand, he does play in the organ, and I use that word a few times, that there are parts of this Sand that sound creepy. You know, if it was, it's an indoor arena, right? So you have the lights by default, but I would imagine that people in certain situations, right when this jam starts, and like you said, Trey, probably, I think that's what the sound is. I think it's the keyboards. It's noise. It's music concrete. It's not really music.
Yeah, and what gets me are the clicks. These arrhythmic tick 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 tick.
Thank you.
It's like, for some reason, that layered in with the whale calls and the siren loops, and then you can hear Page or Trey pick his guitar up and just start playing guitar over all that. But those clicks, I call them clicks. It's like a tick, 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 tick. That gives me sort of the creepy vibes that I like. And in your notes, you said it's for late night dark rooms. And you're right. you know, probably for the same reason I like Fish Just Jams, where you can just put it on and just get the jams. I put this on and you just got so much of that improvisational soundscape that it pleases me.
Yeah, this is a version of this song tailor-made for Fish Just Jams.
Yeah, it is.
Because as you said earlier, there's no wavering between the rhythm, right? This is about soundscapes against rhythm. And I had that thought. I re-listened to this set today. I am a huge fan of The Who. And John Entwistle, the bass player, his nickname for years was Thunderfingers. But I thought maybe for this version of Sand, Mike could borrow that nickname.
Yeah, I almost feel bad for Mike. I'm like, this is just bass player work, you know. He should get paid time and a half for the Sand.
And there are parts of this Sand, it's about 10 and a half minutes, where you can decide whether or not the December 99 tour is for you. It's like solid rhythm with strange soundscapes. Trey was on the keyboards at this point, and repetition. It's when you said, you know, I know you were kind of reading my notes, but where it's for late nights and dark rooms.
Yeah.
This is a jam to get lost in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember back then in the late 90s, whenever I hear that Trey starting off the siren loop, I liked it every time. I'm like, yes, he's doing it. And now things were going to happen. Yeah, I agree. I even will go out to say that this Sand can replace your Barry White for some, you know, late night dark room activities, if you're so of interest. Whereas, like, put on a You Enjoy Myself and you get to the vocal jam, it's no bueno.
No bueno. And interestingly, nowadays in the 3.0 era, Trey has to bring it back to that Sand coda, and you could see it. He makes eye contact with the other band members, pushes his guitar out while he's playing it, and they know when they're going to hit that downbeat to end the song. This one just kind of fades out into the Mango Song.
Yeah. You know, at first I was like, you know, I don't remember much about this show, but as I re-listened and put in some notes, I'm remembering these snippets. And here I recall Trey doing that thing where he stares up through the ceiling, mouth hanging open, and he's just blissfully soloing along, conjuring up some weird King Crimson influence. And he was in his spot. And I was just watching it, like, and I was, you know, probably elbowed my buddy, like, Trey is in the zone right now. He's lost. And we were loving it.
And the Mango Song is a great release from the drama of Sand.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it was a dramatic Sand. That was dramatic music. The Mango Song is like classically beautiful piano. And it reminded me that, oh, yeah, this isn't only a weird drug concert. This is also for
fun musicality, which was what a lot of the first set was about.
Yeah, and I've loved Mango's song since show number one. And you're right, it was a palate cleanser. Like, yes, this is just a beautiful, beautiful Fish song with grape apple pies and some beautiful syncopation between Trey and Paige.
And they follow up the Mango song with Waiting in the Velvet Sea, which is the first cool down of a set of the set. And I was surprised hearing it because I know Waiting in the Velvet Sea is, you know, a nice song. And nowadays it has the extra resonance of the role it played in Coventry. But at this time in 1999, that had not yet happened. But at some point when they were playing the beginning and they were fading into Waiting in the Velvet Sea, there was a huge pause. Do you remember anything about that?
I don't. I wish I did. I hear it, and I was doing it. I don't know why it happened. Maybe everyone had a premonition of the first sunrise in the year 2000, which Waiting in the Velvet Sea, I'm pretty sure, brought in that sunrise at Big Cypress. I don't know why we went nuts, but it was cool. It ended in this really spacey whale space. Yeah. Sounds that I liked, but yeah, who knows? I love the mysterious crowd roars. Sometimes they'll never be solved.
Sometimes it's better that they're not.
Yeah. I don't think there was any naked people running across the stage or anything like that.
And the highlight for me of this set, from a disconnected listener, someone who was not there, was Tweezer coming in after Waiting in the Velvet Sea. I understand why you love Sand so much. It's very obvious when listening to it. To me, the Tweezer just kind of has this joyous release. I mean, there's this interesting stop-start right at the beginning, so you can tell they're listening to each other. They're being a little playful. And at 5 minutes, there's these weird, like, bird noises. I couldn't think of how else to describe them. That, to me, harkened back to Sand. It's like, oh, they're playing with the noises again. Things are going to get weird.
Yeah, I love this Tweezer so much, and I do give Sand the attention, but it birthed this Tweezer that came out at a nice, slow BPM. I estimated it at 83 beats per minute, whereas Picture of Nectar is 88, Live One is 91, and the Tweezer Alpharetta from summer 2023 was a blistering 98 BPM. So this thing is, like, slow, and And my theory is, if you just stand up and when you're listening to this Tweezer and dance, it's like this perfect natural frequency of your body. Like, you could dance like that forever.
And never get tired.
It's like sustainable dancing at 83 BPM to this Tweezer. I always love Tweezer every time. But after the Uncle Ebenezer part and this one, to me, and re-listening, what's happening is they've cracked open the tomb from Raiders of the Lost Ark, and all those blue and white spirits come flying around Reynolds Coliseum again, and it's like, oh, we're back.
Oh, but you gotta back. Shut your eyes. Don't look at it.
don't look at it. It's gonna melt your face off. And once that's released, we're like, we're back in that same creepy zone established by Sand, but it takes us in a different direction, but it's foundationally there, and I loved it being back.
Yeah, and this Tweezer is very representative of the jamming style of the era. Like you said, it's slower than normal. They have a lot of space to fill, and there is this area soon after the jam starts, maybe around like 9 minutes, it sounds like they're about to go into Manteca. And what I love about it is they're playing slow enough and spacey enough while keeping Tweezer coherent that
each band member has his or her, well, not her, but his own space. Each band member has his own space to kind of add a little bit of spice here and there, but no one's taking over. It's a very democratic way of playing.
Absolutely. Even if Trey comes out with something wild, he settles back into his little spot amongst the democratic jamming. Like it's 7.5 minutes. Mike's bass clicks into this womp, 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 womp mode and with a swirl of loops and Paige playing piano. And that is a moment where Mike just does something cool for a few minutes and then settles right back in. I didn't hear that part in 8 to 9 minutes where it might break out into Manteca, but I re-listened to it and I hear it, and I was kind of glad they didn't give us any crab in my shoe mouth, because it might have broken me out of my trance. But we kind of stay in this trance and we stay mesmerized all the way to another transition of the little cool down at like 10 minutes.
Yeah, Fishman lays back, kind of like you did with Limb by Limb a little bit. This time, though, it's still a standard beat, but he uses rim clicks instead of hitting the snare drum hard as he normally does. And he focuses, again, on another feature of 1999, featuring a lot on the cowbell, bringing his woodblocks and his cowbells, pays them a lot of attention at this time in the band's history. Fishman is making it really interesting by about 11 and a half minutes, but he backs off. No one seems ready to take over. Until around 13 to 15 minutes, where in my words, high point of the show.
Yeah. Yeah, you hear Fishman start a fast snare, double hit, triple hit snare action, some fast snare. And then at around 14 minutes, and like you said, it just, it's a highlight of the show to me. From that moment to the end, it's a slow, patient build of this hose of bliss. It doesn't come all at once. You don't even notice it. Like the whale sounds, the sirens, the loops fade out, and it's replaced with this growing, expanding bliss hose.
Thank you.
it's not much going on. If you listen to it, Paige is just playing piano. Mike's playing some simple licks. Trey's playing some really simple little few notes. But Fishman's having a lot of fun. And it builds and builds and builds.
And if you want to talk about Raiders of the Lost Ark, when everything, you know, is going crazy and everything just tumbles back into the Ark, everyone falling together, this tweezer at the end, everyone is in it for the right reasons.
Absolutely. And, you know, these days, like I've seen 60 shows and almost half of them are post-COVID. Because I've, like 2021, I got super excited again. At the end of this tweezer, what I probably am doing is my eyes are closed, I'm smiling, and my hands are open, kind of down by my side, like I'm receiving the information.
Yeah,
it's flowing into me, and I'm like a conduit for this musical information, and it flows it right into my heart. And you're right, it breaks you open, and you feel like you're at the time and place on Earth like no other. Like you're at the right time and place right then. I love it.
And once we're able to recover from the tweezer, they play Runaway Dream, and I did not mention this earlier. I think it was during Back on the Train. The crowd was clapping along really loud, and rarely for a crowd, they were able to keep the beat.
Yeah. I got to say, I probably looked at Thad and said, this is not normal.
Right. It's unusual.
We're clapping. And you're right. We kept it going, clapping on the one, a bunch of mostly white people, pretty long time. And usually it's cringe, the clapping at a concert, but it was okay. We were just happy to be there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was just so surprised. Like you said, it just seems so rare. You know, you talked about Taylor Swift concerts, screaming, singing. She's got to have a bunch of songs where everyone's clapping along. It's just, her music is bouncy. It's made for that. Fish, for all their fun music, we do not get a lot of clap alongs, but it seemed to fit perfectly and kind of elevate the show, make it unique. Compared to, I don't know, if you went to 5 shows in a row, this would probably be the only one where there was a strong standard clap along in 2 songs, not just one.
Yeah, it was Back on the Train, and you're right. I mean, we can't even agree on the proper clapping on Stash, but
right.
I clap 3 times usually, but now I mix it up. Sometimes 3, sometimes 2.
But just the same, Runaway Jim has some really good fiery guitar playing. It's a very strong set closer, which is a role that I kind of don't picture Runaway Jim in. It's actually the opposite. I always picture them opening a show with Runaway Jim.
It was a solid closer, just like wow, what a second set, and going out with a big high energy, and it was fun.
Yeah, there we are, 5 song second set, and the encore, they come on with Bittersweet Motel, which is a very quiet, soft encore compared to the fireworks of set 2. I like Bittersweet Motel. It's a very sweet song. And then they close it, of course, with Tweezer Reprise, the only way to go out. It was obvious, but, you know, no one's going to push it aside.
Yeah, I always love it. The only thing funny about this song is that the word reprise can also be pronounced reprise. But I'm in the majority there, so I'm sticking with the reprise. It's kind of a slow BPM to match the Tweezer compared to the frenzy of some other Tweezer reprises. Again, a memory came back during this review of Trey at the end of this Tweezer reprise taking his guitar and waving it around to create some cool feedback. You know, it wasn't exactly first tube hold it up in the air. It was like wave it around and make some crazy sounds. And I love that so much. He's so playful.
Brent, thank you so much for coming on to Attendance Bias today to take us all the way through December 16th, 1999 at the Reynolds Coliseum in Raleigh, a show that had heretofore been unknown to me, except on paper, and with some big highlights, some really solid versions or standard versions of songs. And how did Thad like it?
Thad liked it. He was like, that was a really good time taking me. And I'm pretty sure that was his only Fish show. Not that he didn't like it, but it was just like, that was a point in his life. I don't know if he thinks about it. He probably doesn't re-listen to it, but we had a good time that night in Raleigh.
And that's it for today's conversation with Brent Somerville. And we got a lot of the facts right, actually, today. There's not a long fact check, but still a few things we do have to correct with today's attendance bias fact check.
Attendance bias fact check.
The Grady Cole Center, where Brent saw his first show on June 24th, 1994, complete with the first Jump Monk in 729 shows, sandwiched within Bathtub Gin, along with a Forbin's Mockingbird and a second set demand opener, is technically a community center. It's hosted its share of high-profile concerts over the years, as Frank Zappa, Dave Matthews Band, the Allman Brothers with Duane Allman, Cheap Trick, Pink Floyd, David Bowie, and others have played the venue. Its modern capacity is 3,000 people. The 1999 Alpine Valley show that Brent saw that summer has been at least partially covered on this podcast, with a fluff head in the first set that lasts just about 30 minutes. I was way off on Camel Walk. I suggested that the band broke it out after a long absence on December 30th, 1997. I must have been thinking of another song, probably Sneaking Sally Through the Alley, because not only did Fish not play Camel Walk at that December 30th show, but the song had been played in Albany on December 12th and before that at Darien Lake in the summer. So even if they did play it on December 30th, which they didn't, it would not have been a bust out anyway. But sticking with Camel Walk, this recording, the conversation with Brent and I, took place in November of 2023 on the 39th anniversary of Camel Walk's debut, November 3rd of 1984 at Slade Hall at University of Vermont. It was debuted in between Can't You Hear Me Knocking and Eyes of the World. Imagine that set list today. And that's it for today's episode. I'd like to thank Brent Somerville for joining me today, Fish.net for its help with the fact check, as well as the Mockingbird Foundation for everything it does for music education, and Fish.in for the recording used in today's episode. If you enjoy Attendance Bias, please support the show by visiting www.buymeacoffee.com/attendancebias and donate anything you can. You can also reach out and follow me on social media at Attendance Bias. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next time on Attendance Bias.